Mark is exactly right. The typical percentage is about 20 to 25% of the questions have some PEDS relevance, both on the board exam, on the in-training exam, after reviewing them multiple times. So there's definitely a lot of information. And I'm sure, as most of your talks have been this week, I have gleaned most of my information through looking at board exam, self-assessment exams, and in-training exams to come with this information. I updated each year with this year the major updates were in, or the major portions are parts of the syndrome talks, because they seem to be tending more towards knowing gene locus, and as they find more gene locus and as I find genes that cause some of these syndromes, they become more testable. They haven't yet asked you questions on those specifically, but I think it's probably in the offing. And obviously I'll be happy to talk to you questions-wise. I was going to try to divide this up into two sessions. I usually try to go about 60% in the first half, so to speak, take a break, get a Coke or whatever it is you want to do at the break, and then come back and do the last 40% to wrap things up. And so I'll be happy to ask your questions at the break or at the end, however things go. So I figured we'd start with neuromuscular troubles or neuromuscular problems in children, and this should go right along your in your handout accordingly in the same order. Neuromuscular problems in children are not limited to what we go over in this talk, but certainly for the purposes of the testing material, the biggest topic is cerebral palsy, which is why we'll talk about that first. By definition, cerebral palsy is a upper motor neuron disease that is non-progressive in nature. Another word to call it would be static encephalopathy. By definition, it has to occur within the first 2 years of life to be qualified in this cerebral palsy category. And an injury to the immature brain, and what it does is it creates a muscle imbalance or spasticity phenomenon. It can infect both upper and lower extremities or total body involvement. There are several ways to classify the cerebral palsy. One would be physiologic, such as spasticity versus athetoid, which is more of a motion type disorder, more cerebellar based, or ataxic or mixed. The majority of the children that we see in almost all the questions on the test are related to spastic type of cerebral palsy. Athetoid CP kids typically do not get contractures. They have a motion disorder, and any time that they come in, it can be totally different depending on the athetosis that's going on at the time. So there's not much in the way of surgical options for athetosis. Most of the time we use bracing and therapy and hardly ever surgery for that. Almost always the surgery is related to spastic CP, and therefore most of the test questions are related to spastic CP. Another version or method of classifying cerebral palsy is anatomical, quadriplegic being, or total body involvement, obviously involving all four extremities, hemiplegic being one side versus the other side, and diplegic being lower extremities more than upper extremities. Sometimes it's difficult clinically to decide between diplegic and quadriplegic patients. From testing purposes, by definition, a quadriplegic difference is that they're not ambulatory. Diplegics have ambulatory capacity, but their lower extremity spasticity is much more significant than their upper extremity spasticity, which makes it a lot easier from a testing purpose than it is actually managing the patient. As far as management options are concerned, you kind of need to think about these four options. Physical therapy, which is a starting point with these patients typically, includes the range of therapies for stretching, lower extremity, upper extremity, occupational therapy, things for functional gain. Bracing and orthotics would be the next step up. Most commonly used braces would be AFOs or ankle-foot orthoses. And then spasticity control would be the next step after that, and surgery sort of as a last resort, or if we find that that's going to give them more advantages. As far as spasticity control is concerned, you have these basic three, and this is all now very testable material. Botox, which is an injectable form, which I'll go over in more detail in a minute. Baclofen, which can be either oral medication or giving a baclofen pump and having intrathecal baclofen. And a rhizotomy, which is surgically trying to treat the spasticity with dorsal root rhizotomy in hopes of diminishing the spasticity. Botox is formulated from the botulinum A toxin, which is definitely been tested over the past 3 to 4 years as far as on your in-training as well as on the board exam. The main things you know about, need to know about it is the way it functions. They inject Botox into the muscle, most commonly the gastroc. And it's a competitive inhibitor at the motor end plate for the cholinergic receptors. So that's why it has a finite lifetime or span of effectiveness. You put an injection of Botox in, it'll last 2 to 3 months, depending on how long it takes it for it to be cleared from the cholinergic receptors. During that time, you're hoping to block the hyperactivity in the gastric muscle and allow for more therapeutic stretching or casting to gain range. So that's the principle on which Botox is used. The mechanism of action of baclofen is largely unknown. We know that it's a GABA agonist, and one of the side effects of it taken orally is that it can cause some diminishment in tone in the upper and lower extremities. Downside on it taken orally is it has systemic effects such as fatigue and tiredness, and so that's not such a great thing. That's why now intrathecal baclofen has become more of a relevant topic for kids that have tremendous lower extremity tone. As far as surgical options are concerned, the orthopedic evaluation essentially boils down to two basic categories. There's either soft tissue procedures, which can include tenotomies, where you just transect the tendon, such as we do commonly at the adductor at the hip. Lengthenings, like we would do for an Achilles tendon lengthening or a hamstring lengthening, and transfers, such as a rectus tendon transfer or a tibialis posterior tendon transfer. Those are the basic soft tissue procedures. And we typically do those early. By early, I mean less than 5 years of age. The bony procedures are typically done for later bone development that occurs as secondary to muscle overpull or muscle imbalance issues, most commonly being at the hip with muscle imbalance causing hip subluxation. The typical exam-type question for cerebral palsy involves an ambulatory child who's diplegic or hemiplegic, because that's the most readily testable option, and they can give you direct words and numbers as far as their range of motion is concerned, unlike what it is in the clinic when you have to try to figure that out just from looking at and examining the child. For example, let's say you have an ambulatory child with hemiplegic cerebral palsy who has toe walking as their major complaint, and then they'll give you a physical exam and say that they have the ankle dorsiflexion on one side to 10 degrees beyond neutral, and on the other side, it lacks 10 degrees from full ankle dorsiflexion. In general, if they're able to dorsiflex their ankle beyond neutral or 5 to 10 degrees beyond neutral, then that's a braceable foot. If you think about it, that means that there's spasticity and tone causing the overriding toe walking phenomenon, and so that's a patient that would be better off braced. On the other hand, if they have lack 10 degrees from full extension dorsiflexion with their knee in full extension, then that's a patient that has a contracture in that muscle, and they're trying to lead you towards the tendo-Achilles lengthening as the option for treatment in that child. The main disorders you see in the diplegic child that's ambulatory is a crouched gait pattern. The problem with crouched gait is that if you just address the heels, then the crouching can become worse. If you just address the hamstrings, it can become worse. It's really hip flexion, knee flexion, and ankle Aquinas that creates this sort of triad or triple level problematic gait issue. Gait analysis has allowed us to further discern this. It's a little more precise in its ability to tell you where the tight muscles are and how you can best address these. Multiple level releases are typically done in one sitting, meaning in one surgical procedure, to try to avoid the anniversary phenomenon where children come back repetitively over and over and over on an annual basis because they have ankles done 1 year, then the knees done the next year, etc. We try to do it all in one sitting. The most likely, this is a common test question, the most likely contracture to recur is the hamstring contracture. And probably that's because a lot of these kids use wheelchairs as they get older for their long distance ambulation needs and use and ambulate independently for more shorter distance or around the home. So the more they're sitting in the chair, the more their knees are flexed and the more the hamstrings can become tight. Over time, this can create an elongated patellar tendon from standing in this crouched position, a patellar alta type position, which is a very difficult problem to treat. I have not seen them ask any questions on the treatment of patellar alta, but it's definitely something that occurs in the children with cerebral palsy that are ambulatory. The stiff knee gait pattern is something that's a very testable material as well. The stiff knee gait pattern is typically in a child that's diplegic and ambulatory. The basic code words that they use are limited knee flexion and swing, difficulty with transitional movements from a chair to standing, or they'll most recently have, say, the child has some limited knee flexion gait abnormalities, underwent a gait analysis and show you a gait analysis that shows EMG evidence of the rectus femoris firing out of phase during the EMG. All these are trying to lead you towards considering doing a rectus femoris transfer to try to get that spastic rectus muscle out of the midline during the swing phase of gait and allow them to have a more neutral or knee flexion swing during their swing phase of gait. Spine deformity is a big issue in children with cerebral palsy. Conceptually, if you think about it, the children that are more involved have more risk for spine deformity. Therefore, the total body involved child or the spastic quadriplegic child that's non-ambulatory is for sure the highest risk. This is the problem that they have. All their weight goes on this downside ischium. They don't have neutral pelvic balance or neutral spine balance, so their pelvis is oblique. And if you're spending your whole day sitting, if you're, you guys have been sitting here the whole week, imagine if you're just sitting on your right hip the whole time. And you shift around in your seat all the time. We all do that just to try to diminish the load from one seat to the other. And if you have to sit that way the whole time, that creates a problem. One thing you can do non-operatively is try to have custom seats made. But any custom seat you made is difficult because you have to readjust it as their spine deformity increases, not to mention the fact that it's hard to diminish the amount of weight that they put on their downside hip. So the vast majority of kids, when they get that kind of deformity, if they're able to withstand the rigors of it, will end up becoming some form of a surgical conversation about how they're going to deal with their severe deformity. The surgical indications from a testing standpoint in scoliosis and cerebral palsy is a child that has a progressive deformity, not a 20-degree curve, but a curve that's gone from 20 to 40 to 50. So over 40 degrees, for sure, is a progressive deformity with sitting imbalance and pelvic obliquity. If they have a 35-degree curve and there's no pelvic obliquity and their sitting balance is excellent, they don't need a spine fusion. On the other hand, if they have progressive deformity with sitting imbalance, those are the patients that they're going to ask you on the test, and their answer is going to be leading you towards surgical treatment because of the obliquity and the sitting imbalance issues associated with it. As far as the management surgically is concerned of these children, the spinal fusion, there's excellent data now documenting that fusing to the pelvis is definitely the way to go, and that recently came out in the last 18 months in JBJS as well as in the Journal of Pediatric Orthopedics, that long-term studies have shown that if not fusing these patients to the pelvis with cerebral palsy, is more than 50% of them have to come back and have a revision extended to the pelvis because you didn't treat their underlying problem, which is their sitting imbalance. And so from that standpoint, fusion to the pelvis is definitely the answer. What technique you use, what rods you use, what screws you use does not matter and is not testable. But fusing to the pelvis is definitely testable. And using segmental fixation. They once again will not ask you, are you going to use wires, are you going to use screws, are you going to use titanium, are you going to use stainless steel? They won't ask you that. What they want to use is segmental fixation, meaning you want to have some type of fixation at each level if possible, or skipping one or two levels is not always possible to accomplish because you sometimes have a laminectomy or something you have to dodge. But segmental fixation implies you have multiple points of fixation throughout the spine. The big controversy now is whether or not you need to do anterior posterior spine fusion or if you, can you do just posterior spine fusion alone. I have an ongoing prospective study myself looking at this very issue. My gut feeling is that posterior alone is going to be adequate, but that's probably not testable. I think that the answer now is posterior spinal fusion with segmental fixation to the pelvis is the code answer for the testing material. Spine deformity is one big issue with cerebral palsy. Another is hip subluxation or dislocation. Neuromuscular hip dysplasia would be another method of describing it in words on the test. The bottom line is you have muscle imbalance like we talked before. Typically, this muscle imbalance involves the hip adductors and hip flexors. These children have lots of tone, and the hip flexors and the adductors creates a scissoring gait pattern commonly when you see them walk. Our goal is to try to prevent the hip from dislocating. The reason for that I'll show you in a few slides, because once the hip's dislocated, it becomes out of round, and once it gets out of round, you can't put a non-round peg inside a round hole. It doesn't work. And then mechanically, it doesn't last and doesn't hold up, and then you get into salvage procedures. So our goal is to try to prevent that dislocation. This is what we mean by a scissoring gait pattern. You can see, by the way, this child walks through swing phase that adductor of the hip just flexes, just pulls that whole leg over across the other side in a scissoring fashion. In kids that are non-ambulatory, the adductor tightness can become severe enough that perineal care, such as changing the diapers on this child, can be very difficult. So although there's perineal care in everyday activities as well as their ambulatory capacity that can be affected by this problem. Here's an example of how we typically treat a well-established or something that's been going on for a long time with imbalance. This hip on the left side here is about 85% dislocated or subluxated, and on the right side perhaps 50%. you can see that as the muscle imbalance continues, you have significant coxa valga, neck shaft angle probably approaching 160 degrees or greater on both of these hips on the left side. So the VDRO, which they have used those letters on the test, the varus derotational osteotomy is what that stands for, is definitely an option. Trying to pull those hips down into a more varus position like you can see was done here on the right side. Typically, we'll try to bring the neck shaft angle down to 120 degrees or so in an ambulator or even farther in a non-ambulator so that they don't grow back out of the operation again. The whole principle, once again, being trying to keep the hips reduced or located within the acetabulum. This is a year and a half post-operative demonstrating that the hips have maintained their position. This is the reason that we do that, because a chronic painful dislocation such as this, the head is no longer round, it's misshapen, and the socket is severely dysplastic. That is not reconstructable. Putting that hip back in the socket is not an option. They have tested on this material as well. You basically have three options in this category. Option one is to leave it alone and deal with it best you can, but they're not going to test that if they're at this point. The other two options are, one of them is counterintuitive. It's called an abduction osteotomy. Abduction osteotomy essentially means you make more valgus. So you make a laterally based closing wedge osteotomy like this to pull that hip further away from the pelvis, because the problem we think is that the femoral head rubs against the ilium, and that creates cartilage degeneration, and then subsequent pain develops just like it would in a degenerative joint. So an abduction osteotomy is one option. The other option is a proximal femoral resection, girdle stone procedure, where you come in surgically, make your cut here, and take this entire proximal femur out. They both have pluses and minuses. The downside on the proximal femoral resection is you take a stiff, painful leg and make a floppy leg. You took the whole proximal femur out, now there's no support proximally, so that leg can piston and move around. That has pluses and minuses. The abduction osteotomy, that hip is still going to be quite stiff because you still have the same length. You're just hoping that it doesn't grow back and start touching the ilium again and causing pain again. So they have pluses and minuses, and as you can see, neither one is perfect, which is why we try to keep the hip in the sock to begin with. That is the hip that I just showed you. So you can see why it's painful, and that's why we try to do everything we can to keep the hip in the socket as far as preventiveness is concerned. Down to the foot in cerebral palsy, there's two basic problems. The foot can either go into equinus and valgus or equinus and varus, depending on the hind foot and the ligamentous laxity of the child. If they have ligamentous laxity in general underlying, they tend to go into an equinovalgus position at the foot. The reason for that is somewhat biomechanical in nature. If you have a tight Achilles tendon, as you can see, this taut Achilles tendon coming down from the gastroc on both sides, it's a shorter distance from the gastroc to the calcaneus insertion if the hind foot's in valgus. So if the foot collapses into valgus, and if the tendon's tight, it just collapses into valgus, and that shortens the distance, and that makes it a continual problem. The problem these children get is then they also subsequently, that's the hind foot deformity, they also get uncoverage of their midfoot of the talonavicular joint along the way. So the treatment for this is that the primary problem is the Achilles tendon, because the Achilles tendon tightness is what led to that foot collapsing into valgus. And so you do Achilles tendon lengthening, and we've found over time, we being pediatric orthopedists, that doing just that is probably not enough in these children with this ligamentous laxity. So we usually add either a calcaneal osteotomy or a subtalar arthroresis, which is called a Grice procedure. I'll show you two examples that show what that means. A Grice procedure is arthroresis with the RE, because it's technically not an arthrodesis. You take a bone block, typically iliac crest, that it can be allograft. You see the talus pointing directly vertically here in this flat foot on the left side of the screen. You pull that hind foot back into a more neutral position, and then you put, from the laterally based approach, because it's a valgus deformity, you put a block of bone in the subtalar joint in this location right here to try to block it from going into valgus. So that's one potential option. A more preferred option from myself, with personal preference, would be this, a lateral column lengthening procedure, because then I don't violate the joint, which is why I like this better. So this you can see, this child has a vertical talus, as you can see here, coming almost vertically from the tibial plafond because of the valgus positioning of the hind foot. If you lengthen that lateral column by performing an osteotomy just proximal to the calcaneal cuboid joint, lengthen that lateral column, you can swing the hind foot back into a more neutral position and then maintain that length and not have to violate the joint. Both of these bone procedures work well if they're accompanied by an Achilles tendon lengthening. And that's something that's definitely in vogue as far as treatment is concerned for equinovalgus deformities. The equinovarus deformity, which is coming in the opposite way if they don't have the laxity in the hind foot, typically those kids have overpull in the tibialis posterior in addition to the Achilles tendon. Typically they show you a picture like this one of a child walking with this dynamic foot deformity. Most commonly they'll have a gait analysis on the test question just to show you that there's either overactivity in the tibialis posterior or not. And there's two basic treatment options for this as well. One is makes lots of sense if you have a spastic tibialis posterior muscle. Transfer that muscle, half of it, to the lateral border of the foot and lengthen the Achilles tendon to try to balance the foot like you would with the reins on a horse. Have half that tibialis posterior tendon going medial and half going lateral. Typically, we insert it into the peroneus brevis so that you have a good grip on the lateral border of the foot as well. The Rancho procedure, which I have seen them ask it a test question and just say Rancho procedure and expect you to know what it entails. The Rancho procedure basically has three components. There's a tendo-Achilles lengthening, a fractional lengthening of the tibialis posterior because that's what's causing the varus, and they split the tibialis anterior tendon and take half of it lateral instead of the tibialis posterior. So those three. Lengthen the tibialis posterior, lengthen the gastroc, or the Achilles, and transfer the tibialis anterior to the lateral border of the foot to try to balance the foot. Both of them are trying to balance the foot with a soft tissue tendon transfer. So that's the main questions that you'll see over and over and over again in the cerebral palsy or spastic cerebral palsy treatment realm. So let's move on now to myelodysplasia, also known as spina bifida. It's a failure of neural tube closure. This is what it looks like in an infant. The risk factors, which is very testable, are these four: folate deficiency, valproic acid use, maternal diabetes, which is a big one, and maternal hyperthermia. Most of these are correctable and notable, and most of these now are treatable. Therefore, the rate, overall rate of myelodysplasia is declining. It's not anywhere near zero, but in children that and with our increased perinatal care, it seems to be diminishing at least to some degree, which is good, obviously. The myelodysplasia is probably the most tested neuromuscular disorder on an exam, and I think largely because they can use strict anatomical guidelines, and it can be both an anatomy question and a neuromuscular question. For example, the lowest level functioning is how you describe the level. So if I said to you, this child is a L4 spina bifida child, just as a thought process, there's no questioning. If they're in the clinic, they say, oh, I don't know, maybe there's a little hamstring, maybe it's L4-5, it's a bargain. Not on the test. It's either L4, it's L5, S1, etc. So then what they want to know is what's functioning. So then you have to know what's the L4 nerve root, what's the L5 nerve root, what do those do? So it becomes an anatomy question. So that's why the myelodysplasia is one of the most heavily hit areas. And if you think about it, don't let it scare you. It's a real easy question. If they say L4, you have tibialis anterior will be intact. If they say L5, probably have a hamstring. S1 would be gastroc. It's easy once you think about it and just say, okay, it's not really a myelodysplasia question. It's an anatomy question. The other three big things you need to know about myelodysplasia is that if they have changes in function, they're implying that spinal cord is being tethered or stretched, so you need to get an MRI. The reason that's true is 100% of the kids with spina bifida have a tethered cord. The first slide I showed you with the child with their neural elements all open, the treatment for that is to close it. Anytime you close it, there's a scar. Anytime you have a scar, there's going to be some tethering of the cord. It's just a matter of whether or not it's symptomatic. So as this child's spine grows in length, if that spinal cord's tethered at the bottom and it's growing in length, there could be changes in function. For example, if the child is an L5, the way they would test you on that, the child is L5-S1 level functional myelomeningocele, now comes into the clinic and is non-ambulatory and on clinical exam is an L2 level. Well, that changed function by three levels. First thing you have to think about is there must be a tether. We better get an MRI. And they'll try to lead you astray and say, oh, it's probably a foot deformity. You should do some surgery or x-rays. You better get an MRI to make sure there's not a tethering of the cord that needs to be released. The third thing is the IgE-mediated latex allergy. They're obviously not going to say ask you if you know about latex allergy and myelodysplasia. That would be too easy. They're going to say something like the child's having a child with spina bifida is having an anterior posterior spine fusion. During the anterior exposure, there's minimal blood loss, 50 to 100 cc's of blood loss. 1 hour into the procedure, despite the minimal blood loss, there's a precipitous loss of blood pressure, hypotension, and hypoxia. That is the latex allergy. And that's what they want you to know. It's IgE mediated. The little particles of the latex get form an eluent from the body fluids and then creates this IgE mediated profound anaphylaxis. So that's why 100% of the time you have latex allergies written across the whole chart of the patients with myelomeningocele, so you don't use latex gloves. The last thing that I want you to know for sure on myelodysplasia, and I'll go into some more details on myelodysplasia, is that fractures are common. And they love to fool you on the fractures. They'll say a child with L3 level spina bifida comes in with ankle pain and swelling and redness. And then they'll somewhere in their little creepy way of writing the test question say that on exam of the ankle that you can feel crepitance. Somewhere in there, that'll the crepitance word, or there'll be some instability, or something will be written in there to make you, if you blow over it, you'll automatically think this is an infection. It's red, it's warm, and it's swollen. It's got to be an infection. And in spina bifida, they do get a lot of infections. But don't forget about fractures, because they're insensate. If it's an L3 level, they don't feel their ankle. And so that's what they're trying to fool you on, is to make sure you don't miss that. The infection rate is alarmingly high. If you need to have your confidence brought down a little bit, just start operating on kids with spina bifida, and that'll take care of that problem for you real fast. One of the most commonly asked questions in spina bifida that has to do with an anatomical variation is, what is the most common level for children with mild dysplasia to have a hip dislocation? Well, if you remember this chart, then this question's easy. It's L3-4, because if you look at the line right here between L3 and L4, if you're L3 or higher, so if you're an L3-4 level, you have active hip flexion and active hip adduction, which when we just talked about CP, they have over a muscle imbalance. So that causes hip subluxation and eventual hip dislocation. If you have L5 function, you have a hip abductor. So the abductors can counteract the adductors and balance that hip a little better, and they don't typically get hip dislocations. So L3-4 is the most common level to get hip dislocations. They also can get abduction contractures. If their L5 root is stronger, they can get significant abduction contractures. That's a problem for a sitting child because they have trouble getting their hips in within a wheelchair, and that can be a big problem. So an Obreyant procedure is one that's been described where you do a double lengthening of the iliotibial band, one proximal and one distal, in hopes of getting their hip abduction contractures under better control. With the lower extremity in the myelodysplasia, you want to try to keep the kids upright and ambulatory as long as you can to try to increase their bone stock so that you can hopefully minimize the fractures and the osteopenic issues they have as an adult. One thing we'll use to do that in children that are L4 level, let's say, and have weak quadriceps is a KAFO. I put that on there because they asked that 3 years ago. The KAFO stands for knee, ankle, foot, orthosis. I'm sure you're getting lots of rehab talks this week, too, where they'll be going over those kind of things with you. But that's something we use commonly to try to keep them upright and ambulatory. Foot deformities are extremely common. If you think about it, the lumbosacral nerve roots are the lowest on the spinal cord, most commonly involved in myelodysplasia, and that's what innervates the foot. And so the foot deformities are huge and a large portion of the deformities. At least 60 to 70% incidence of foot deformities in children with myelodysplasia. They can run the gamut of club feet, which are very severe and stiff and syndromic type club feet, not the typical idiopathic club feet, vertical talus, and calcaneous foot deformities, depending on the deformity and the overpull situation. The club feet are very rigid, and the biggest problem you have to worry about with these specific to myelodysplasia as opposed to idiopathic club feet, which we'll talk about later this afternoon, is that these children are insensate in their foot. And so if you try to do a lot of manipulation on their casting, they will slough their skin, they'll get skin blisters, they'll have big problems. And so most of the time, children with myelodysplasia end up having surgical release of their deformity, a much higher percentage than do children that have idiopathic club feet. A lot of times they'll have severe rotational deformities in the lower extremities as well because of the overpull, and commonly we'll treat these with a derotational osteotomy of the tibia in hopes of obtaining a plantigrade or neutral position of the foot as possible. By far and away, the most common deformity in children with myelodysplasia is scoliosis. And if you think about it common sense-wise, why doesn't that make sense? Because they have a spine deformity. They have, by definition, they have congenital spine deformity. Their neural tube did not close. That's why they have myelodysplasia or spina bifida. So therefore, they have a congenital anomaly in the vertebra, and therefore the incidence of scoliosis is tremendously high. The higher the level of the myelodysplasia, the higher the level of the scoliosis incidence. 100% of the children that have thoracic level myelodysplasia have scoliosis. And the biggest thing to remember is that bracing is, not only is it ineffective, it's contraindicated. By definition, a congenital scoliosis is not a braceable scoliosis. You have a vertebral bar, you have abnormal shaped vertebra, there's no brace that's going to be effective in treating that. Once again, the biggest thing you need to remember is if you have any change in function, one method that can test you on that is if you have a child with a 20 degree scoliosis, it's a L1 level spina bifida, and they return in 6 months and their curve is now 40 degrees, you better get an MRI to make sure that's not the first symptom of that spinal cord tethering that we talked about a minute ago, and that's why you get an MRI for any kind of rapid progression. The treatment of spine deformity in myelodysplasia from a testing standpoint is completely non-controversial. You have to do an anterior-posterior spine fusion, and for sure on the test you have to do anterior-posterior spine fusion. To remember it in your mind so that it's not just another fact, it's very difficult to get a child with spinal bifida to fuse posteriorly. They have no posterior elements. That's why their spinal cord was floating in the breeze when they were born, because there's no posterior elements. So to try to accomplish a posterior spine fusion is very difficult. So you have to do an anterior fusion 100% of the time, anterior and posterior. The pseudoarthrosis rate, even with that, is very high, and the infection rate is alarmingly high as 25%. And probably the reason the infection rate is so high is we put this much hardware in a child that has very thin skin overlying. It basically goes skin, three cells of fat, and then dura. That's their back. And so there's very little soft tissue coverage in that area, and so that the infection rate is very high accordingly. Another particular spine deformity associated with spinal bifida is a markedly severe congenital kyphosis, gibbous-type deformity like this. That's a thoracolumbar junction coming up in at least 150 degrees of kyphosis. The problem with this is in a non-ambulatory child is a thoracic global spinal bifida. The point that touches the chair are their hips and that, the bump over the gibbous. So the skin is very thin because that's where their defect was. They get constant breakdown issues. And so that has been tested, and the answer for that is to do a kyphectomy. This is that child's deformity. You can see it looks like a roller coaster, about 180-degree lumbar kyphosis. Kyphectomy means you come in and you resect several vertebrae across the apical segments of that kyphosis and then do whatever type of fixation you can accomplish and get covered to push that spine into a more neutral position in hopes of eliminating their contact point with their chair. So those are the two big issues, the spinal bifida and cerebral palsy from a neuromuscular standpoint. Arthrogryposis I include in the neuromuscular category. It has specific things related to it that you need to know about from a testing standpoint. You may never see a child with arthrogryposis in your practice, or you may see one or two, but not a lot. They typically have multiple congenitally rigid joints. That's what arthrogryposis means. The biggest thing to remember from a testing standpoint, and when you're talking to these kids, they are normal intelligence. Commonly, they will be straight-A students. I think a large portion of that is because they do have normal, their brain is fine, and they can't really do anything with their body. They can't do any kind of physical activity, so they read a lot, they use computers a lot, and they're very intelligent kids. And their sensation's intact. When you see the pictures I'll show you in the next couple of slides, if you haven't seen a child with arthrogryposis before, it's hard to imagine that a child that looks like that can have normal intelligence and have normal sensation, but they do. And the problem is that they have decreased anterior horn cells, which is the main cause of their issue. And it's one in about 3,000 live births, so it's not a very common problem. The treatment is 100% based on their function. Largely in orthopedics in general, that should be our plan, is to treat people based on their function. But specifically in kids with arthrogryposis, you have to take their special situation in under consideration, the fact that they're in a wheelchair, and you want to try to improve their life as much as you can if you're going to deal with them. This is what the typical child will look like. They aren't able to move their joints, so they'll have no flexion creases at the elbow commonly. Elbow will be stuck straight. The knee will be flexed and not have any extension creases. And these are very rigid joints. And these children have they can usually move their fingers slightly, but they're very much markedly ulnar deviated or radially deviated and flexed. So they can usually run an electric chair, and they usually do cruise around in an electric wheelchair. And they use a computer extensively. Since they've gotten more technology in the wheelchairs and the electrical ability to do it with a computer, it's a great advance for these children to be able to be more independent. But nonetheless, they have normal intelligence and normal sensation. It's usually quadrumelic, meaning it involves all four extremities, and they have marked limitation in range of motion. Their club feet are, just like the rest of their body, extremely rigid, probably some of the most rigid feet you'll ever see. And the treatment is solely based on these kids, most of the time being getting that foot to be shoeable. Especially, I mean, if you live in a warm climate, that may not be as big an issue, but at least they have to pour some kind of coverage on their foot in this area for sure. And so commonly we'll try soft tissue procedures, but unfortunately the recurrence rate is exceedingly high, and we commonly have to go back and do bone procedures, including as much as a talectomy at times, remove the talus to allow the foot to have enough flexibility to come into a more neutral position. They very commonly have teratologic hip dislocations, and this slide is on there independently for a very good reason, because they will commonly try to have this x-ray on a child with arthrogryposis and ask you, what is your treatment? And if you didn't know it was arthrogryposis, or you didn't know what arthrogryposis was, you would probably say pavic harness because it's dislocated hip. Sure, put a pavic harness on it. But that is contraindicated. The reason it's contraindicated is a pavic harness, by definition, has to have a reducible hip. It's flexible and reducible. If it's not reducible, then the pavic harness will just be pushing that femoral head against the ilium, and it won't ever come back in, and in fact can create harm, create avascular necrosis in the proximal femur. So a teratologic dislocated hip, such as the children with arthrogryposis have, you can see this already has a pseudoacetabulum. Here's the real acetabulum. Here's the pseudoacetabulum from that femoral head being lodged up against the ilium. So it's a syndromic teratologic hip, and you cannot put that child in the pavic harness. The treatment options for this are either open reduction surgically, or leave it out. Those are your two choices. Larsen syndrome is another form of a teratologic hip dislocation. This is a classic x-ray to show you on the test, and this is a one in a million syndrome. I mean, you see this, I have one patient that in my practice, I haven't had him come back once a year so that whoever's on my rotating with me can see the child, essentially, because there's not much else to do at the current time. But they have multiple joint dislocations. In the lower extremity, you can see here, bilateral hip dislocations, knee dislocations, radial head dislocations. Cervical kyphosis is a big issue, and that's actually what they've been testing over the last 5 years, is they'll show you a child, they might, one time they even said a child has Larsen syndrome or has a familial multiple joint dislocation syndrome, and you had to know that those children are at high risk for cervical kyphosis, and that was on the test. And the cervical kyphosis can be devastating. So the check a cervical spine radiograph or an MRI of the cervical spine or examine the cervical spine would be the answer. Duchenne's muscular dystrophy is very easily testable. This slide depicts what a Gower sign is. It's a sex-linked recessive phenomenon. They have a markedly elevated CPK and the Gower sign where they walk themselves up their body to stand up. They have calf pseudohypertrophy. Their calf is enormously large. And the reason is they have infiltration. Instead of having normal muscle, such as you see on this portion of the slide, they have connective tissue infiltration, which gives them the calf pseudohypertrophy. The big things to know are the hip extensors are the first muscles to be affected. That's why they have to use their hands to push their body up straight on a Gower sign. So the hip extensors are the first affected muscles, the gluteal muscles. You do a muscle biopsy, and you'll see the CT, connective tissue infiltration. And the biggest, most recent thing is on DNA testing, they have an absent dystrophin protein. And that is something you need to make sure you understand. Dystrophin is a normal protein in the human body. If you do not have the dystrophin protein, if you have none, then that is Duchenne's muscular dystrophy. I'll talk about Becker's, which is a less severe form, in a minute. The children with Becker's typically have present dystrophin, but either dysfunctional or not as much as normal. So dystrophin is a normal protein. It's absent in Duchenne's muscular dystrophy. The big testable question from spine standpoint on Duchenne's muscular dystrophy is scoliosis. Children that have curves that progress up to 20 to 25 degrees, surgery is an option at that point. And that makes a wonderful ability for them to test you and then make sure you're thinking clearly. If they show you a child with idiopathic scoliosis or cerebral palsy with scoliosis that has a 25 degree scoliosis, you wouldn't think about operating on it. You would choose the option of observation, further follow-up, et cetera. In a child with Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, if they show you a child has a straight spine and then a year later has a 25-degree curve or a 30-degree curve, the answer is going to be surgery as an option because that's typical for Duchenne's muscular dystrophy. If you're going to operate on them with scoliosis, you should do it when the curve is small as the first sign of progression, because as the curve gets bigger, their disease gets bigger and they get respiratory compromised and they have more difficulty getting through the surgery. So when you have progression, that's when you operate on it. And that's distinctly different from idiopathic scoliosis. And when they ask you that on a test, they will for sure ask you, a curve magnitude that you would either brace or observe in idiopathic scoliosis, such as a 35-degree curve or 25-degree curve. In Duchenne's muscular dystrophy, the surgery is the answer. I can't say that word very good, so fascioscapulohumeral muscular dystrophy, FSH muscular dystrophy, is autosomal dominant. They have normal CPK. The biggest thing they have, their hallmark, is the scapular winging that you see, and they are unable to whistle because of their facial muscle weakness. It's the one indication that I think makes the most sense to do a scapulothoracic arthrodesis. Because you take a child like this who's unable to abduct his arm, you fuse his scapula, and he can get at least up to 90 from an abduction standpoint, because it stabilizes the scapula, and that makes it more functional for them. Becker's, as I talked about several slides ago, they have abnormal or less than normal amounts of dystrophin as compared to Duchenne's, where they don't have the dystrophin protein. So therefore, it's less severe, they usually live longer, and it's sex-linked recessive. Friedreich's ataxia and Charcot-Marie tooth, which will be the last two in the neuromuscular section, are in the HSMN category, hereditary sensory motor neuropathies. There's now, I believe, 8 or so of those. Orthopedically, what these cause is cavus feet. The specifics for Friedreich's ataxia is that it also causes the cardiomyopathy and scoliosis. Typically, they'll have a wide base gait because it's spinocerebellar in nature, and they have significantly rigid, high-arched cavus feet with claw toes as well. The big catch with Friedreich's ataxia is they have scoliosis and they have cardiomyopathy. The scoliosis can progress up to a very severe form, and the cardiomyopathy is also very much an issue when you're operating on their spine, so you have to have a cardiology consult. That might be an answer, for example. If the child has Friedreich's ataxia and scoliosis, what would be part of your pre-op workup? Cardiology consult. That's one method of them figuring out that you understand they have cardiomyopathy. Charcot-Marie tooth, the feet look very similar to the Friedreich's ataxia children. It's autosomal dominant. They have very severe cavus feet, which can become quite rigid in nature, and obviously it's familial. The most affected muscles are these four, the intrinsics of the hand and the foot, as well as the peroneus brevis and the tibialis anterior. All right, so that's the neuromuscular challenge that you'll see, and that's very heavily hit typically on the in-training exam. The spine section, and particularly the pediatric spine, is usually 5 or 6 questions on the in-training exam or on the board exam type question. And I'll go into the categories on how they ask those questions. It's not quite as heavy, so to speak, as the neuromuscular, but I'll go over the salient features, and I'd be happy to answer any other questions that you have. As far as scoliosis is concerned, obviously the idiopathic variety gets subcategorized, the adolescent, juvenile, and infantile. And you have to know the three categories because it all makes very good test material and it's treatment-based. The idiopathic adolescent variety, right thoracic curves predominate and left thoracic curves are rare. A left thoracic curve is usually an indicator on a test that if it's an adolescent with a left thoracic curve, you better be thinking, oh, is there something else going on? Maybe it's not idiopathic, and therefore you need to get an MRI to rule out the possibility of a cyst or a syrinx. There are two predominant classifications in the literature over the last 25 years, the King classification being sort of the gold standard of the past, I'll say, came out in the 1980s, and the Lenke classification, which recently came out about 2 to 3 years ago. The Lenke classification is heavily researched, outcome, and treatment-based, and is becoming more and more the wave. To my knowledge, I haven't seen a test question at all on the in-training or the board question where they make you classify it King classification or Lenke classification. That may be coming in the future, but I don't see it as happening just yet because it's extremely complicated. The biggest thing is you've got to make sure that it's idiopathic scoliosis you're dealing with. You want to make sure there's not a cyst or a syrinx. So if there's a left thoracic curve, if they have lots of back pain on a test question, if they have lots of back pain, if they have a left thoracic curve, if there's some kind of neurologic issue on exam, they're not able to walk normally, then you probably should get an MRI to make sure that there's not some other type of problem that could be potentially causing the scoliosis. The biggest factors that affect progression, the age of the patient, skeletal maturity index, peak growth velocity, curve magnitude, and curve type. The top three are all kind of go together. People go through their peak growth velocity in their pre-adolescent growth spurt. In females, that's usually just prior to menarche. Males are not as predictable, but they always have a peak spike where their growth goes up, and they'll grow 3 to 4 inches in that 1 year. The skeletal maturity index is typically done by Risser sign, as you see on the right side of the screen here. Risser divided the ileum into four sections, each accomplishing 25%. Zero is no apoptosis, and five is completely covered and fused, and everywhere in between in 25% increments. Curve magnitude, curves less than 20 degrees typically do not progress. Over 20 degrees, the progression rate jumps up by about 50%. And the type and location. Thoracic curves are much more likely to progress than lumbar curves. And double curves, meaning a thoracic curve, double thoracic curve, or a thoracic and a lumbar curve, is much more likely to progress than a single thoracic curve or a single lumbar curve. Progression after maturity. This slide right here is how you should make your decisions about how you answer the test question, as well as how you treat these patients. Long-term studies have shown that thoracic curves greater than 40 degrees will continue to progress after maturity. That's why 40, and actually that number is down to 45 degrees. That's why 45-degree curves are bigger, and a child is still growing. Virtually 100% chance that curve is going to continue to progress in adulthood, let alone how much more it's going to progress during the rest of their growing years. Lumbar curves, the number is 30 degrees. Over 30 degrees, curves typically continue to progress throughout the rest of their life. And usually it's 1 to 2 degrees per year. So that gives you an index for answering test questions. If you have a 50-degree curve, on the test they do not ask you gray zone questions on a surgery for a posterior spine fusion or idiopathic scoliosis. They will not ask you a 41-degree right thoracic scoliosis. They'll ask you a 50-degree curve, or they'll ask you a 30-degree curve. They will not ask you a gray zone question. In my experience looking back multiple times, that's not happened. So if it's over 50 in thoracic spine, they're going to want you to go to the surgery route. And I'll go over that in some more detail. So this allows you to, if you know that slide, allows you to categorize this. And that's basically all the questions on idiopathic scoliosis from an adolescent standpoint. If it's less than 20 degrees, we know the progression rate is small. So we're going to observe those patients. Between 25 and 40, or if they started at 18 and went up to 25, that's a brace category. They won't make you pick a Boston brace versus a Charleston brace, et cetera. They'll just say orthotic treatment or brace treatment, some form of the bracing therapy. And over 50 degrees is going to be a surgery category. It is that cut and dry on idiopathic scoliosis, adolescent idiopathic scoliosis on a test. One of the few things that is that cut and dry. And they don't make you measure it either. They always have it measured out for you. As far as the options for surgery are concerned, that's where it can get a little more controversial. Most cases, from a testing standpoint, posterior spine fusion with instrumentation is the answer. They haven't make you pick hooks, screws, wires, etc., or the brand, but they'll just say posterior fusion with instrumentation as your treatment, or anterior fusion with instrumentation. The anterior answer is predominantly for thoracolumbar curves, but even now that's becoming more controversial as people trend to do more things posteriorly now than they were anterior. So my guess is that they're going to probably fade away from the anterior instrumentation answers on the test questions. Anterior-posterior fusion is indicated currently for severe curves greater than 75 degrees and or curves of skeletal maturity, kids less than 10 years old. The answer to the second one with skeletal immaturity is related to a phenomenon called crankshaft phenomenon, which I'll show you a slide of in a minute. If you have a posterior fusion which can't grow anymore, and the anterior fusion continues, anterior vertebra continues to grow, it will spin around the posterior fusion, creating a crankshaft phenomenon and worsening the deformity. So anterior fusion takes away the anterior growth and therefore eliminates the crankshaft phenomenon. The way they'll make you want to know that answer is they'll say you have a 9-year-old child with a 50-degree curve, or an 8-year-old child with a 50-degree curve, and they'll have on the answers posterior fusion or anterior posterior fusion. The answer to that would be anterior and posterior because of the crankshaft risk. And they will say it that way because if they put 80-degree curve, you probably would think automatically, oh, it needs anterior-posterior for release purposes. They'll do that to trick you to make sure you understand that the crankshaft is the phenomenon on a kid less than 10 years of age. That's a visual depiction of what crankshaft phenomenon is. You have a posterior solid fusion mass, and the anterior vertebra continues to grow, spinning around the posterior fusion. These are potential complications that you can have with idiopathic scoliosis. I've seen all of them on the test. Neurologic injury is pretty obvious, obviously. You're operating on a spine. Pseudoarthrosis typically presents itself as late pain. The two things that present as late pain typically are pseudoarthrosis and delayed infections. Pain over the implants, pain in the area where the fusion was, You have to think on the test. Is this patient have an infection, or is it not fused, or is it not healed? Flat back syndrome is hopefully a thing in the past. With our segmental constructs, we're able to reconstitute the sagittal contour and pay as much attention to that as we are the coronal plane. But flat back syndrome came from having a distraction construct across the lumbar spine in particular, posteriorly, creating diminishing the lumbar lordosis. Crankshaft is what we just talked about. SMA, I put it that way intentionally because that's the way they've asked it on the test. Stands for superior mesenteric artery syndrome. Typically happens in thin kids that have a lot of correction. 60 or 70 degree curve that you get to take down to 10 or a small number. In a small child, that as you do that, you can create a superior mesenteric artery syndrome, which causes significant bowel problems. The treatment for it is an NG tube because they get, basically it's an obstruction of their GI tract. So you do an NG tube to decompress their stomach and give them IV fluids and probably TPN to try to get them nutritionally balanced until they can come get over their SMA. The causative organism for delayed infections now is more than 50% Propionibacter acnes. And that's been on the test a lot. That's why I put it on a separate slide. So if they have persistent pain, these two issues you need to think about. Is it a pseudoarthrosis? Other thing the pseudoarthrosis can do that an infection wouldn't is the deformity can progress. If it doesn't fuse, the deformity can continue to worsen. So worsening deformity in a child that has pain after a spine fusion, think pseudoarthrosis heavily. The infection issue is typically greater than a year. The delayed infection, by definition, is greater than a year, 9 to 10 months after the surgery with persistent pain. And they commonly have minimal symptoms, and their wound will look fine. You open up the incision and can culture it, and the majority of them are growing Propionibacter acnes. So that's the adolescent group. The infantile group, I intentionally have next because it has several characteristics which are in contrast. Number one being the child is young, obviously, less than 3 years of age. The category for infantile is 0 to 3 years. Juvenile is that 3 to 10 span, and adolescence above that. The biggest thing is their left thoracic curves. Remember, adolescents were right thoracic. Infantiles are left thoracic. Infantiles also, the males predominant. In adolescents, females predominant. The biggest thing you have to know from a measurement standpoint, they won't make you do it, but just so you know what it is the RVAD, and they usually write it like that. They'll say that RVAD, and that stands for rib vertebral angle difference. Dr. Mehta described this years ago. I have a slide here demonstrating how you measure it if you're interested. They won't make you measure it on the test. They might show it to you, or they'll give you the number. They'll say the RVAD is this. The way you measure it is you draw your typical Cobb angle with a vertical coming up 90 degrees from it. Then you draw at this, and this is done at the apical vertebra. So in this curve, it would be right here. You draw your Cobb measurement with a vertical, and then you draw a line subtending the rib head on each side of that apical vertebra. So the difference between this angle and this angle is your rib vertebral angle difference. And so that's basically what it is. It's complicated if you look at the thing, but what it is, it's a measure of the rotation. If the child doesn't has a curve but without much rotation, then that rib vertebral angle will be about the same. The ribs will come off about the same angle on both sides. On the other hand, if there's a lot of rotation, the side that's rotated towards, the rib will come off at a steep angle, and on the other side, it'll come off at its normal neutral angle. So that'll be a bigger difference. So the kids that have a bigger rib vertebral angle difference have more rotation in their deformity. And the reason that's important is, and very particular and peculiar to infantile scoliosis is, if you have a mild curve, let's say a 30-degree curve, and a rib vertebral angle difference of less than 20 degrees, meaning there's not much rotation, virtually 90% of those curves will resolve and go away spontaneously, and probably they're positional in nature from inside the womb. So that's obviously crucial for treatment, as well as it's easily testable material, and that doesn't happen in any other kind of scoliosis. The second category is kids that have curves in that 25 to 35 degree range with a rib vertebral angle difference bigger than 20. They have a mild amount of rotation and a moderate curve severity. That's probably a curve that's going to get worse, or at least is worthy watching or treating. So those children are going to be treated either casting, where you manipulate and try to push that spine into a straighter position, or bracing. It's hard to brace a kid that's 2 years old or 2 months old because they outgrow it so fast. So commonly we'll cast them and then just continue to change the cast along the way. And the last category is occurs up and over 40 degrees with a rib vertebral angle over 20 degrees. Those kids need to have an MRI to make sure they don't have a dysraphic lesion, a cyst, a syrinx, a tether, a tumor, etc. And largely, those kids will end up having surgery of some form. And I don't think it's testable at all to have you pick what kind of surgery in a two-year-old anymore, because there's so many different options with the Vector, which I'll go over in a second, growing rods and definitive fusion. It's too controversial. I think they might say that this child will need surgery or make you guide that you need to get an MRI to make sure there's not a dysraphic lesion. But you have to know that because of the size of the curve and the rib vertebral angle difference, that curve is at very high risk for progression. So there's basically two types of infantile scoliosis, the type that goes away and the type that's very bad. And there's not much in between. The last category of idiopathic scoliosis is juvenile onset, which is the gap, the 3-year-old to the 10-year-old. These kids have a very high rate of progression. If you thought about one of my initial slides on scoliosis was the risk for with skeletal maturity, the age of the patient, and amount of growth remaining. Well, if you're 4 and you have a scoliosis already, you have 10 years of growth remaining at least, so you're a very high risk for progression. At least 50% of these kids end up ultimately requiring surgery for treatment of their deformity. They also have a very high incidence of cord abnormalities, so spinal cord MRIs are warranted on these children, as high as 18 to 20% recorded in the literature of anomalies on MRIs. Most of them will require anterior-posterior spine fusion if they're less than 10 because of the crankshaft phenomenon we talked about earlier. The treatment categories are all the same as they are for adolescent. Less than 20 is observation, 25 to 40 is bracing, and over 50 is surgery as far as testmanship is concerned. So that's the idiopathic variety. The congenital variety is the next phase. Congenital scoliosis implies either A, a failure of segmentation, which would be a bar or a bridge that didn't break down, didn't divide in the embryo, or a failure of formation, a hemivertebra, where only half a vertebra formed and the other half didn't, or some combination of both. The biggest thing to remember in congenital spine deformity from a starting standpoint with your evaluation is you have to rule out other associated anomalies. If you think about this, the spine is developing in about the 8-week-old embryo. Exactly the same time, the GU tract is developing, the cardiac tract is developing, cardiac system is developing, and the neurologic tract is developing. So that's why you see those three systems listed as having a high percentage of a comorbidity or co-anomaly. So you need to first, in your mind, say, get an MRI, assess their GU system, get a cardiac evaluation to make sure they don't have the other anomalies as well. As far as treatment is concerned, the worst prognosis would be if you have failure of formation on one side and failure of segmentation on the other side. So in easier words, if you have a hemivertebra on the left side and a bar on the right side, that is virtually a 100% chance of progression. You have no potential for growth on the bar side, and all potential on the hemivertebra side. That combination is lethal as far as progression is concerned. So there's 100% incidence of progression in that instance. The treatment of congenital scoliosis, the only one that you'd say will do treatment on site is the one we just talked about. If you see a child with a 30-degree scoliosis, and they'll ask you this too because of the number, a 30-degree scoliosis with an ipsilateral failure of formation or failure of segmentation and a contralateral failure of formation, surgery is the immediate answer on that. It'll be anterior-posterior in-situ fusion. So that means front-back, and because of the crankshaft phenomenon, you want to stop the growth. In-situ means rather than trying to correct that deformity, you want to fuse it in-situ so that it doesn't get worse, so it stays at 30 degrees and doesn't progress beyond that. That's the only one that you treat on-site in congenital scoliosis. The rest of them, first thing you do is you rule out the associated anomalies like we talked about on the initial slide, the GU tract, cardiac, and the neurologic axis. Then the rest of them you treat for documented progression. And the documented part of that is the key. In congenital scoliosis, 10 degrees is considered documented progression. Because if you think about it, this curve is pretty easy to distinguish. But if you have multiple hemivertebras in a bar, it can be really hard to decide where you put your Cobb angle. So you have to have 10 degrees to call it documented progression. And from a test standpoint, they can make that very clear. Obviously, they'll say it went from 35 to 48 or something of that nature to show documented progression. The textbook answer is an anterior-posterior spine fusion without instrumentation and in-situ fusion. The reason for that is instrumentation throws added power, yes, and added correctability, yes, but it also has added risk. You have a congenitally anomalous spine with anomalous nerve roots, and the incidence of neurologic injury is higher as well. So from a test standpoint, the answer is anterior-posterior fusion in-situ, unless you have what this picture shows. an oblique takeoff at the lumbosacral junction. I think I've seen it three times in the last 5 years or 6 years on either the in-training or the board exam, where they've had an L5 level or an L4 level hemivertebra with an oblique takeoff in a child with a huge trunk shift leaning way out to the side. And the answer was hemivertebrectomy and posterior spinal and spinal fusion. Every other time, it's anterior posterior in situ on the test. At the lumbosacral junction with the oblique takeoff, the answer will be hemivertebrectomy and posterior spinal fusion. So I put this slide on there just so that you would be aware of it. And remember, I can't imagine that they would ask you technical questions about the Vector. Vector stands for vertical expanding prosthetic titanium rib. So it's a titanium rib prosthesis. It was designed for kids that have fused ribs and congenital scoliosis. They get what we call a thoracic insufficiency. The ribs can't expand, so they can't grow. Their lungs can't grow, and it leads to suffocation, basically, and they die at a young age because of their lack of thoracic lung development. I put it on there because it's been all over the JBJS for about the past 2 years. If you're not interested in pediatric orthopedics, you probably went and got another cup of coffee and turned a few pages and came back and read the Nest article or something of that nature. But it is going to be on there eventually to know what it is, and that's what it's for. You attach it, you do rib osteotomies, and you spread the ribs over time sequentially on an every six-month basis or so to allow the lung to develop and grow. And it's actually a life-saving procedure for these kids if their lungs can grow. So it's probably going to come in the future. I don't think they're going to ask you here in the next 2 to 3 years. Certainly not on this year's test, I wouldn't think. So let's go to the other plane, being kyphosis. Congenital kyphosis is similar to congenital scoliosis in that it's a failure of formation or a failure of segmentation, but it happens in the opposite plane. Rather than being in the AP plane, it's in the lateral plane. It is for sure the highest risk spinal deformity for neurologic injury or neurologic compromise. And I've seen them ask that question and list the other forms of deformity. Congenital kyphosis is the highest risk because the spinal cord is tethered over this apical deformity that's progressively worsening in nature, and it creates a prolongation of the spinal cord and creates problems from paraplegia on from numbness and tingling on up to paraplegia. The treatment for this is either a posterior fusion alone, which would essentially be a convex hemiepiphyseodesis, meaning you're trying to stop the growth on the convex side of the deformity and allow what growth there is on the anterior side to continue to grow, or a more definitive answer would be an anterior posterior fusion, where you just say we're going to fuse it anteriorly in the front and the back, take away all the growth, and then accept that that deformity is going to stay in that position but not get worse. And in situ without instrumentation is for sure the answer on the test question because the risk of neurologic compromise is so high in this deformity.